Oyez. Honorable Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable Supreme Court of Texas are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Be seated. This morning, the court has four matters consolidated into three arguments on its oral submission docket. In the order of the presentation, they are Jerry L. Henson versus Southern Farm Bureau Casualty Insurance Company and Texas Farm Bureau Mutual Insurance Company from Terry County, Fortune Production Company and Others versus Conoco from Harris County, and N. Ray Kenneth George, consolidated for oral argument with N. Ray Ethics Holdings Incorporated and Others, original mandamus proceedings. In each of these matters, the court has allotted 20 minutes for each side to present oral argument. The petitioner or relator may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by advising the marshal of the court. We will take a brief recess in between the presentation of each argument and conclude the arguments by lunch. We are recording these arguments for the court's convenience, and you may purchase a tape of the arguments for a nominal fee by making application with our clerk's office. The court is ready to hear argument from petitioner in Henson versus Southern Farm Bureau.
May it please the court, Mr. Ken Cowan will present argument for the petitioner. The petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. May it please this honorable court and Mr. Welk. The issue in this case is whether or not prejudgment interest is ever recoverable in an underinsured motorist coverage claim or in any contract claim where the words legally entitled to recover are used to describe the damages that are available to a litigant. This is and should be the only issue before this court at this time because this is the only issue which has been preserved for review for the Court of Appeals, which was presented to the trial court and to this court in the respondent's response to the petition for review in this case.
Okay, let me ask you a question so I'm clear on this. You would, for underinsured or uninsured, do you agree that at some point there has to be either an agreement or a litigation as to whether or not the underinsured defendant is liable and the amount that they're liable for? I mean, do you agree that you have to do that?
No, Your Honor. No more so than in any other kind of unliquidated damage case.
So, if the defendant is not liable and does not owe any damages, you would still have a claim against your policy for underinsured. How do you determine that you had an underinsured defendant if you don't somehow either get an agreement as to what their liability and damages are or litigate what their liability and damages?
The classical way, Justice Enoch, is for the parties to conduct an investigation, a thorough investigation of the facts and damages involved, and then to evaluate the potential exposure or liability of the parties involved, and then, of course, the damages in addition to that.
So the parties could either agree to that, or if they didn't agree to that, you'd have to litigate that issue.
Yes, much as would be the case in any standard third party.
Now, if you litigated that issue as to the defendant's liability and the amount of damages that the defendant is liable for, and I'm talking about the tortfeasor, I'm talking about the underinsured person here, that would result in a judgment for damages plus prejudgment interest from 6 months after the accident or whatever the claim is under Kavanaugh. Right.
It's modified by the legislature in 569-1.05 regarding the date of notice of the claim.
And that judgment would include prejudgment interest.
Unquestionably, yes, Your Honor.
Now, if that judgment is within the policy limits of the underinsured portion of your policy, the policy would require them to pay that which the defendant is legally obligated to pay, which is the amount of the judgment, and you be paid, and it'd be whatever the amount of that judgment was, and that would include prejudgment interest. Right? Now, we're talking about it's all within the cap on the underinsured policy. That would all get paid because that's within the, that is what they are legally obligated to pay. The tort fees are defended.
That's correct. After trial on the merits, Your Honor, any damages over and above the amount of the underlying liability coverage.
All right. Now, in this case, the judgment for $133,000 against Ms. Contreras includes all the damages, including prejudgment interest?
No, Your Honor.
But you could have. I mean, your judgment against her could have.
Yes, had Ms. Contreras be adequately and completely insured?
No, because insurance doesn't play a part in the tort claim against her.
Well, I'm sorry, Your Honor, regardless of insurance, had Ms. Contreras not settled out and had the plaintiff obtained that $133,000 judgment against her, yes, that would be the actual damages owed. And then as this court has made clear in Johnson and Higgins, then the additional damages for prejudgment interest would be due on that $133,000.
Right, that's just a question. That's just a matter of law on the additional. So your judgment against did you have a judgment against Contreras?
No, Your Honor. Contreras is his carrier. After their evaluation and investigation, decided that she would, in all likelihood, be found to be responsible for the collision, at least in some substantial amount. And they tendered their liability limits to the plaintiff in this case, which were nominal, which were $20,000.
So you did not, you never got a judgment against Contreras, and you never got an award of prejudgment interest against Contreras?
That's correct, John, because Mrs. Contreras and her carrier exercised the right that any defendant Texas has when confronted with the possibility or the probability that they will be found liable for damages. She exercised her right to evaluate and settle that case. Of course, there was one additional right that she could have exercised without settling, and that would have been to have made a settlement offer to have delayed the accrual of prejudgment interest, even if the parties couldn't come together for a complete settlement of the case.
So she was never legally obligated for the prejudgment interest?
She never paid any. Had the case gone to trial against her, had she not settled the case, and had we gone to trial on the claim against her involving her, and she was, of course, joined with Robert Milliken at one time at the beginning, then we would have been entitled to obtain an award of prejudgment interest under Kavanaugh.
Okay. Well, I'm just going, it wasn't clear to me from the briefs that you didn't have a judgment. I thought you had a $133,000 judgment against Contreras, and
that was the jury verdict. That amount was the damages awarded by the jury sustained by the plaintiff.
But there was no judgment entered.
There was a judgment entered, which since Ms. Contreras had settled out after the lawsuit was filed, and since the two UM carriers, and by UM I'm referring to underinsured motorist coverage carriers, also provided a defense to Robert Milliken, since that Milliken was represented by Farm Bureau under his liability coverage, and since both the UM coverages were also Farm Bureau, Farm Bureau desired to not load up on defense costs, pay multiple lawyers, in essence, to try the same issue.
Well, you're going to be on me. I just wanted to clarify. It was not clear to me from the brief that Contreras had a judgment, but there is not a judgment against Contreras in this record.
I believe there's an agreed judgment, either of dismissal or an agreed judgment.
That's all I was asking about, was a judgment against Contreras. Go ahead with your argument.
Thank you, Justine. The policy limits issue raised in this case for the first time by the respondents in their brief on the merits is not properly preserved, and this court's aware that under Appellate Rule 53.2F, to properly preserve a point of error for this court, it must first be presented to the trial court, and then it must be assigned as error in the Court of Appeals, and that was not done here. Even if it were properly preserved,
the respondent won in the Court of Appeals.
I'm sorry, Judge.
Respondent won in the Court of Appeals. Why did they have to raise it there?
Because of Rule 53.2F. If someone is relying,
my understanding that rule just acts is
if someone wishes to, the petition in this court must state all issues or points presented for review, and if the matter complained of originated in the trial court, it must have been preserved for appellate review in the trial court and assigned as error in the court of appeals. That's the rule.
Weren't you the appellate in the court of appeals?
Yes, sir.
Well, what is there to assign? They like the judgment.
Oh, I understand.
The respondent liked the judgment.
I still have her.
They can't complain of error because it went their way.
Well, that's true. They do like the judgment. Yes.
So I'm not clear on what there was to raise in the court of appeals for the respondent.
Well, of course, there was a hotly contested issue with cross-summary judgments before the trial court, and perhaps the court is correct as to the court of appeals. Maybe the point is nobody ever heard of that issue until the brief on the merits was filed in this court. Regardless of whether or not it was considered by this court, the opinion in Potomac v. Harrod should govern that argument. There the court, 14th Court of Appeals, considered the exact issue, this policy limits issue, not long after Kavanaugh had been handed down and Perry Ruffin v. Alcott, and did a good job of explaining why that prejudgment interest is additional damages allowed by law as promulgated in Kavanaugh to add to the actual damages recoverable by claimant, regardless of whether those actual damages are policy limits available under an insurance policy or $20,000 due under a roofing contract, or for that matter, as in the scenario of Johnson Higgins v. Kenco, where two corporations are involved in a dispute over goods or services. This court has made that particular phrase clear in at least four of its decisions that have been handed down since Kavanaugh, to include Perry Ruffin v. Alcott, Rio Grande, Texas Land and Cattle Company, and more recently, January of 1998, at Johnson Higgins v. Kenco. Were not for the no writ opinion in the Court of Appeals case of Sykes v. Zaloga, we probably would not be here today. That is very nearly the only case and the only authority that the respondents can find to come up with the argument presented in this case. As the Court's aware, Sykes v. Zaloga was not a prejudgment interest case. The respondents in this case have never cited a prejudgment interest case where that issue has actually been presented to an appellate court in this state and decided in their favor. The reason for that is pretty clear when one goes back and does a survey of this court's opinions and the Court of Appeals' opinions. There are strong goals and objectives that were sought by this court to be accomplished whenever Kavanaugh v. Quality Control Park and Eat was decided. And when the follow-up on that, when Kavanaugh was extended to contract claims.
What do you contend is the beginning date of the running of that prejudgment interest? When the claim is made?
We actually, it would be 180 days after Mr. Henson gave notice, written notice of his claim to the, of his union claim to the insurance company.
To his own insurance.
To his own insurance company. This court overruled 88 years of law in Kavanaugh v. Quality Control Inc. When it did so, it overruled that law in the context of a patchwork scheme of prejudgment interest rules, which had in essence began to eat away or largely eat away the DITCA in Watkins v. Junker, which basically stood for the proposition that prejudgment interest could not be recoverable on an unliquidated damage claim. When the court overruled that dicta, it was faced with a modern trend whereby the states were allowing prejudgment interest on unliquidated damage claims, and it was faced with express criticism by the U.S. Supreme Court of any rule that didn't allow someone to recover interest on unliquidated damages. And it was faced in this patchwork scheme that existed prior to Kavanaugh with various rules, or in essence, exceptions that had riddled Watkins v. Junker that did allow the recovery of prejudgment interest on some kind of unliquidated damage.
Now, if you have a suit on a contract, say it's your own insurance company and they owe you some money and they've not paid you and you sue under the contract, wouldn't you be entitled to prejudgment interest?
Yeah, you would prior to this case, Your Honor.
And that prejudgment interest would run from when to when? Up to the judgment, but from what date? From the date of the breach of the contract or the date the lawsuit was filed?
This court has crafted some different rules for that. In Latin injury cases, for instance, this court has announced one rule.
And I'm not talking about injury case. I'm just talking about suit on a contract. You have a contract with the insurance company. It's your insurance company. They owe you some money they haven't paid. You can sue them, and you can get prejudgment interest in that case. And when does that prejudgment interest begin to run?
180 days after you give written notice to your insurance company of your claim. That issue was an important issue that this court just recently decided in Johnson & Higgins v. Kenneco, which was an open question. And as the court recognized in that case, there was a lot of confusion as to when interest began to accrue. And that question was answered to some extent. Johnson & Kenneco was the end-all case in that it decided the final general rules regarding prejudgment interest. All other questions other than perhaps exceptions or citations of prejudgment interest questions were decided in Johnson & Higgins. And so doing, the court laid down a set of rules that were symmetric, and it stated in Johnson & Higgins for the first time since Kavanaugh that symmetry in this area of the law, clarity in this area of the law, in addition to equity in this area of the law, was sought to be accomplished by the Supreme Court's decision and opinion in Johnson & Higgins v. Kenneco, as it had from the beginning.
Yeah, what have other states done on this issue? Have they addressed this point? And if so, is our statutory scheme different so we should treat it any differently?
I cannot, Justice O'Neill, I cannot tell you. I have not done a survey in order to be able to answer that question correctly. I can tell you this court did when Kavanaugh was decided in 1985. And within that opinion is a discussion of the fact that the modern trend was to allow prejudgment interest on unliquidated damage claims. Now,
but you're aware of no other authority in this context from other jurisdictions?
Well, I'm aware of the fact. In fact, there, if I'm not mistaken, there's a case decided in Kavanaugh of other jurisdictions that have allowed prejudgment interest on unliquidated damages.
I'm not talking about on unliquidated damages. I'm talking about under an insurance policy, under the UN provisions of an insurance policy. Are you aware of any other law from other states in that area?
Actually, Justice O'Neill, that's an interesting question because... That's an interesting question because the case, Potomac v. Howard, forms the basis of an LR annotation on the issue of whether or not prejudgment interest is recoverable in the UM case. I don't know how many other cases are out there. I know there's at least three or four because I've seen that LR.
Do you know which way they go?
I know, of course, Potomac went our way in interpreting Texas law. I believe all the other cases are out-of-state cases, and no, I do not. I don't recall. I know that there are, I believe, at least one or two others that support the result and rationale in Potomac.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
In place of the court, Mr. Douglas Welch and Mr. Larry Wharton will present argument for the respondents. Mr. Welch will open the first 15 minutes.
In place of the court, Mr. Cowan. Throughout the briefing and the hearing of this case, it's seemed to me that we're talking about two different cases. Mr. Cowley wants to talk about recovering prejudgment interest on his UM limits. We say that there is a condition in that contract, and actually there are two UM policies, that he has to satisfy before he ever recovers a first dollar under those uninsured motorist
policies. Why is that different from any other lawsuit? When you file a lawsuit and damages are unliquidated, we allow there. Why should this be treated any different?
Well, our position is you don't get to recover any prejudgment interest if you don't first prove that you breached the contract. Our position is that the Farm Bureau companies have never breached the contract. The proceedings in this case were such that the parties agreed to be bound by the judgment in the case against the third party. And pursuant to that agreement, we agreed that if the findings in that case said that Ms. Contreras was underinsured, that we pay the limits within 30 days. And that's precisely what the Farm Bureau did
here. The Criterion case lets you sue the insured record.
Right. We were looking at the Criterion versus Brown case and the three different ways that you can proceed.
If you sue the insured record, which Criterion lets you do, would you get prejudgment interest in that case?
If you sued the insured?
No, the insurer.
The insurer. If you prove that they breached the contract, I think. In this case, he made a claim, and the facts of this case kind of muddy the water a little bit because Mr. Cowling's client maintained a claim on his own as well as a claim for loss of consortium by his wife. His client was a passenger in the Milliken vehicle, and so Farm Bureau didn't know it at the time the lawsuit was filed. He maintained a claim against Contreras and Milliken for negligence. So Farm Bureau didn't know under Milliken's policy whether they needed to answer under the bodily injury limits or if Milliken was if Contreras was an underinsured motorist, making Hansen an additional insured under the Milliken policy. Now, I'm sure the reason behind this, why we main,